This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Where can you find the smartest kids in the world? It's not an easy question. It's probably not even a fair question. But it's a question that one journalist and author sought to answer by following three U.S. students as they studied in countries with some of the best education outcomes in the world.
Teenagers there, virtually all of them, are learning to think critically in math, reading, and science, which is really unbelievable.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, the search for the smartest kids in the world. Then we'll turn around and look the other way to hear how four students from large cities around the world cope in a tiny, and I mean tiny, Montana town. And we'll spend an academic minute looking at the other leg on the education stool, evaluating teachers. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When talking about education outcomes, the conversation almost always goes to comparing the U.S. with other countries. It's a fact that there are places around the world with much better educational systems, and they don't spend nearly as much money per student as U.S. schools do. So where do the smartest kids in the world live? Amanda Ripley is a journalist who has written a series of acclaimed articles about learning and children in Time magazine and The Atlantic. She wanted to answer that question and started by following three U.S. students as they studied abroad for a year in countries with superior outcomes. The result is her book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. I recently spoke with Amanda Ripley and asked how she chose the kids and countries in the book.
I wanted to know what it was like to actually be a kid in the smartest countries in the world. So I needed to follow actual students, but it was most helpful to follow exchange students, American teenagers who were living in these countries for a year, but could, in a very narrow but deep way, compare what they saw in their schools and homes abroad to what life and education was like in their schools and homes back in the U.S.
These three kids were already pretty exceptional students, right?
In some ways, they were. Kim was an example of a student who had never left the United States. She was 15, and she just really wanted to see the world. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, and so she heard that Finland had some of the smartest kids in the world, and she thought it seemed like an intriguing place. So she decided she really wanted to go there, and she raised $10,000 all by herself and went there for a year. So each of them has their own story, their own motivations for why they left, but they were unbelievably valuable in helping me focus on what actually matters to real-life students on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to the things, you know, that we as adults tend to get fixated on.
And you had Kim, who went to Finland. You also had students who went to Korea and to Poland. What did these countries either have in common or just made them interesting to focus on?
Finland and South Korea consistently score at the top of the world on a relatively sophisticated test of critical thinking in math, reading, and science. So teenagers there, virtually all of them, are learning to think critically in math, reading, and science, which is really unbelievable. It's a very unusual situation. And then Poland is interesting because although it hasn't achieved the heights of Finland or Korea, it's dramatically improved its education results in the past 10 years, even though it has a pretty high level of child poverty, comparable to the child poverty level in the U.S. So that's exciting because you can actually see the metamorphosis that it has made, as opposed to just looking at the very top of the world. It's also interesting to see how they got there.
Did all of these students find this as rewarding or interesting as they thought it might have been going in?
You know, there's lots and lots and lots of good things and bad things about these countries and about their experiences. They did not hesitate to share their opinions. They saw many things that they really liked about their schools and homes and cultures abroad and things that they missed about the U.S. When I surveyed hundreds of exchange students, you know, to sort of see if there were patterns in what they said in addition to the kids I was following, there was a remarkable consensus about certain things. So, for example, they all pretty much agreed that school in the U.S. was just easier, just full stop, just easier. And American kids who had lived abroad agreed with that, actually, that their classes in the U.S. were easier and that, you know, there were definitely some reasons for that. They talked about how sports were more important to American kids, and they also agreed on that across the board. But, you know, many of them also pointed out that the exchange students who came here really, really like their American teachers And they found that the teachers were much more accessible and friendly and interactive than their teachers in other countries. So, you know, it's a complicated thing. You obviously, you know, it's hard to generalize about a country as big and diverse as the U.S., but there's a lot to be learned from actually listening to students themselves.
You seem to say that the students abroad don't do many extracurricular activities, and that seems to be a help. Am I getting that right?
There is a real clarity of mission and purpose in the schools in these countries, and those schools are about academic rigor. They're about learning, and that doesn't mean that there's nothing fun that happens. And I mean, certainly in Finland, the students' lives are pretty balanced. They're not working night and day the way they are in Korea. But the purpose of school is clearly to learn at a high level. And there are lots of reasons why that is and lots of ways that kids get that message. But when kids play sports, and they do play sports in these countries, they play them outside of school. They do, you know, pickup soccer games, or they do a league through the community rec center or something organized by parents. But it's not part of the mission of school the way it is in U.S. high school.
You say that old school is good school. I've seen that in a few of the materials I got about this book. Explain what you mean by that.
One of the things that kids who go to these countries notice on their very first day of school is that the classrooms are like an American classroom in the 1950s. They don't see the technology that they saw in their American classrooms. Even in sort of mediocre or low-performing schools in the U.S., you do tend to see smart boards, digital whiteboards on some of the classroom walls. You see laptops and computers and now iPads. These are things that Americans tend to be very excited about, particularly adults, but don't actually yield learning when you study the impact of those investments. So it is interesting because Korea and Finland are actually pretty sophisticated places from a technology standpoint, but their schools are really pretty austere, and the priority, again, is on learning rather than facilities or technology.
It's the shiny object syndrome, you say.
Right. I mean, clearly, look, for all our strengths in the U.S., we have a kind of fascination with stuff, with gear and consuming things. And that is something that I think it's important to be conscious about and aware of and resist the urge to just buy smart boards for every classroom, unless you know that it's actually going to lead to learning. And, you know, spend that money on things that you actually know help kids learn, as opposed to things that adults get excited about.
One of the things we hear when talking about education in the U.S. is that there are just too many tests now. They're teaching to the test. There's too many tests. But you say there aren't too many tests. They're just the wrong kind, right?
Right. I mean, we have too many dumb tests, right, and not enough smart ones. And I think that is a theme that you see over and over again. It's not just in the U.S., by the way. I mean, this is a problem many countries grapple with. In the really exceptionally high-performing countries, what you see is there are plenty of tests, but they're typically smarter and more challenging. So they are important to help. You can't get better at something unless you measure how you're doing, right? I mean, that's just, so we can't do away with tests. That's an insane idea. But what you want to do is, for the tests that you have, make sure that they're smart, make sure that they're giving you information that you can really act on, and they're not just done for the sake of tests themselves.
Okay, I'm going to open this can of worms. Do we have too many teachers?
We educate too many teachers. So our colleges and universities make quite a bit of money off of their education colleges. It is, I think, the second most popular major in the United States. We educate twice as many teachers as we need, and we have done that for some time. Many countries make this mistake. Again, we are not the only ones. We do not make it challenging and rigorous to be accepted into education college, generally speaking. So that means that not only do our teachers themselves sometimes have, you know, challenges in their own educational background, but maybe more importantly, we don't take that opportunity to send a signal to everyone else. By making a profession selective and rigorous, you send a signal to kids and parents and politicians that you are really serious about this. And it becomes easier to pay teachers more. It becomes easier to get kids to buy into the premise of school. And all these beautiful things flow from making the gateway to teaching much more serious and rigorous. You know, that isn't enough into itself, but I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, the top performing countries in the world all make it much harder to even begin the process of studying to be a teacher.
And you point out, too, that the top-performing countries in the world have very strong teachers' unions, which is, again, something we hear a lot about in the U.S. Oh, it's all the teachers' unions' fault.
Right. Yeah, this is surprising. Every country in the world that I looked at seems to have a very strong teachers' union. And, you know, it's very hard to dismiss a teacher for poor performance on any country that I've seen. So this alone does not explain our situation. I mean, certainly we have challenges with our labor relations and, you know, there are lots of things we could talk about in that direction. But that alone is not enough. And so people who think it's all the union's fault are simplifying this problem in a way that is not very helpful, because it's the same deal in Finland, same deal in Korea. You know, the teachers' unions are very powerful everywhere on Earth.
Well, the U.S. is going towards the Common Core standards now. Is that a step in the right direction?
The Common Core state standards are definitely a step in the right direction. It's not enough unto itself, but if you just look at them, you can go online and look at them, you can see that those requirements are very clearly asking kids to think more for themselves, to do more rigorous work. You know, it's not true in every state, but in most states, this is a significant improvement. And it really just, you know, it really offers kids and teachers a chance to go more deeply in fewer topics rather than trying to touch everything and never really getting fluent in any particular subject. So I think that's actually really exciting and encouraging. And we'll see, you know, we'll see if it sticks, because there's quite a bit of backlash towards the Common Core, as you know.
Finally, are there any preconceived notions you had going into this project that just got totally exploded out?
Definitely. I think I underestimated how much other kids matter to kids. You know, as an adult, you forget that student-peer cultures are contagious. And, you know, we tend to talk a lot in the education world or in the media about policies and adults and how we can change curriculum and all these things. But, you know, what happens is there's an inflection point in these really high-performing countries where, for a lot of reasons, kids are buying into school. They connect the dots between what they're doing and how interesting their lives are going to be and what kind of car they're going to drive. And there's this real kind of clarity of purpose that we struggle to achieve in most of our states. So that kind of thing is important. And to think about, how do you cultivate that drive? Because these countries didn't always have it. You know, this is something that is malleable, and that's encouraging.
Yes, well, that's why in the U.S. all the brains hang out together in school.
Right, but, you know, it goes very deep. I mean, in Korea, there is no concept of the nerd. Like, that just, the social capital is in academic accomplishments. The same exact way we in America look at athletics is how Koreans look at academics. I mean, literally, there is no difference in the intensity and sometimes insanity and obsessiveness of Korean parents towards academics and American parents towards sports. So, you know, I think much can be learned from thinking about how we could shift some of that enthusiasm and you know, some of that fun and joy and competition from athletics into academics.
Well, when they start selling tickets to the Regents exams, then I know we'll have made it.
That's right. I don't think we'll leave the seat at, but maybe.
Again, the name of Amanda Ripley's book is The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. You can read more at AmandaRipley.com. Still to come, so how do some foreign students fare in a really small U.S. school? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1197. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Okay, we've heard how some U.S. students did while studying in other countries. Now let's turn that story around and hear about four exchange students, one each from large cities in China, Thailand, Korea, and Mexico, who spent a year in tiny Judith Gap, Montana. And I mean tiny. Judith Gap has 120 inhabitants, and the high school had an enrollment of only two before the exchange students arrived. Clay Scott from the series Mountain West Voices has their story.
My name is Jian Zhang, actually my Chinese name, and everyone call me Jasmine.
Well, my English name is Jennifer Zhang, and my Korean, real name is Ka Hyun Jung.
I'm Paloma Gonzalez, I'm from Mexico, León, Guanajuato, and I'm actually, today's my birthday, so I'm 16, turning 16.
My name is Ploy Thapanpakun, and my real name is Manansaya Thapanpakun. Ploy is like nickname. I'm from Bangkok, Thailand, and now I'm in Judith Gap, Montana.
During the past school year, Jasmine, Jennifer, Paloma, and Ploy made up two-thirds of the student body of Judith Gap High. There were only two American high school students. All four of the exchange students come from cities of several million people, and all of them have attended schools with thousands of students. Judith Gap has shrunk to about 120 inhabitants, and the school has fewer than 40 students total in all grades. Most of them come from the wheat farms and cattle ranches in this sparsely populated part of the state.
The first day I arrive here, and it's like in the middle of nowhere, totally. It's really peaceful here. Like, nothing is moving, no traffic, no the car, the noises.
It was weird when I first came here, but now I'm used to it. Yeah. The first day I came here, I arrived like at night. So when I woke up, there was like nothing here. And I was like, where's everybody? But then I just came to school and there was like just nine people in the high school. And I'm basically... Well, me and my roommate, we are the class of sophomores, the sophomore class. So it was like a shock. But now it's normal. So I guess when I go back, it's going to be weird to see all the people everywhere.
I like the school. I like the people. Because I'm from the big school, like 5,000 students. And here's just like 40. And I like the way it's small because we know everyone. Like from kindergarten to seniors, and I like that.
I was worried about how can we have class or something because we have four exchange students and we just have two American students. But I think it's better than Korean class to me because we can have conversation with teachers directly. So I think it's better. I like it.
I think here the teachers care more about the student.
I'll miss the people, because here in Judith Gap, everybody's so nice. Everybody's trying to help and all that. And well, in the city, you don't know anybody. In the streets, you are just like other person in there. And here you know everybody, so it's really nice about it. And I'll miss the school, because you are like friend with everybody, so yeah.
I'll miss all the teachers I had this year, and my friends, and maybe this peaceful. Yeah, this kind of peaceful, like you only can hear the bird, that's all.
Well, I like Judith Gap. I tell my friend that I'm in Judith Gap, Montana, and they say, where the heck is that? I don't know. I just like it here.
When you go back home and talk to your friends, your classmates, they say, and they'll say, Montana, where is that? Judith Gap, where is that? And when you explain to them what this experience was like for you, what will you tell them?
Well, of course, I will say it's small town. People are always nice to us if they don't know us. And they always say, hello, but I don't know him, but we can know each other later. It's small town, but this town is like small family. I like small community now.
ตอนนี้เราอยู่ใน Judith Gap Montana
然后今年作为一个交换生到 Judith Gap Montana 这个小镇。
You've been listening to students at Judith Gap High School in Judith Gap, Montana. This is Mountain West Voices. Our series is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana. Additional support was provided by the Greater Montana Foundation. To see images of today's story and to listen to and download more than 120 stories of life in the Rocky Mountain West, go to mountainwestvoices.org. I'm Clay Scott.
The concept of observing and grading teachers has been talked about a lot recently, and that's nothing new. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I am Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. By the end of the 19th century, public education had become a central feature of American society. Stephen Mucher, professor of history education at Bard College, describes how the recognition of education's importance inspired early efforts to observe teachers and their students.
In May of 1881, teachers in Battle Creek, Michigan, nervously welcomed two special visitors to their high school. Historian Charles Adams and mathematician Wooster Beeman arrived with purpose. These university professors had come to evaluate teaching. Any anxiety those teachers experienced that day may feel familiar to educators today. Many are now facing consequential scored observations from administrators. But quantifying teaching never crossed the mind of Adams or Beeman. These scholars were part of a radical new accreditation plan designed to strengthen college enrollment. The plan got dozens of liberal arts professors down from the ivory tower and into schools. Visit reports show that Adams and Beeman carried no scorecard. They went seeking allies. They voiced conviction that teaching is complex. They sought evidence that teachers cared about what they taught. They made consequential judgments, but they agreed that teaching is human and difficult to measure. They left Battle Creek impressed. But on hundreds of similar visits, observers walked away discouraged. Too often they witnessed uninspired teaching. From this, they drew one central conclusion. Teachers lacked content knowledge. Routine school visitation dignified teachers and triggered soul-searching among professors. This partnership sparked a noble conversation between them. Within a decade, the faculty began offering elective courses on the teaching of disciplinary content. These professors also formed a club, inviting teachers to campus annually for pedagogical discussions about subject matter. Among the club founders was a 25-year-old philosopher named John Dewey. Dewey would be heartened by all this recent attention to classroom practice, but he might puzzle over how we now score teachers. He might ask why professors so rarely visit schools, and he might wonder what became of that noble conversation.
That was Stephen Mucher of Bard College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.